Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. We're rejoining our conversation for this episode about how to remake Britain with political economist, writer and author Will Hutton, chief leader writer and columnist at The Observer, Sonia Soda, and the political strategist, journalist and podcaster, Alistair Campbell. And a surprise guest on the night. Jump back an episode to hear the first part featuring a live on-stage in-depth conversation with none other than Labour leader Keir Starmer. And if you want to hear even more of what was such a great discussion between all our panel, you can get the exclusive Members Only Part 3 installment by becoming a member of Intelligence Squared. Just head to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. Now let's jump back into Part 2. Our panel was on stage to talk about many of the themes from Will Hutton's new book, This Time No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain. Here's Sonia Soda live on stage with more.
I want to ask you both what you made of Keir's response on young people, because for me, I do look at some of the issues that young people are facing, and it's kind of very hard to see where the answers are coming from on things like housing, on the awful amount of debt that young people are racking up by going to university. Do you think Keir's answer went far enough? I'll come to you first, Will, and then Alistair.
Well, it didn't, obviously, it did go far enough, did it? I mean, he has this strategy of kind of minimalism, kind of doesn't want the kind of whole conservative media and political and think tank ecosystem to kind of take him apart in the next 6 to 9 months. I mean, and this minimalism has got into where he's got to, what an average in the polls of what 20-point lead. And it's the old analogy of carrying a Ming vase and not wanting to drop it, which was used for Tony and now is being used for kind of for Keir. But the condition of 18 to 35-year-olds in Britain, you put it all there. I mean, we can't carry on kind of loading people with student debt and maybe with apprenticeship debt, if that's the road you go down, to kind of finance vocational training, and then expect them to become part of a property owning democracy by supporting the mortgages on house prices on a literally 140-year high in London. House prices are 12 times average incomes. And we're watching, I mean, you can see it around here. I mean, it's not just pubs closing, it's schools closing, it's primary schools closing. It's kind of, because people can't afford to bring families up in kind of zone one and zone two. And that's going to, it's a contagion. So, there has to be, the proportion, I mean, if you're 35, you're on average spending 2/5 of your disposable income on servicing rent or mortgage. I mean, that's why I saw what I said about spraying the muck around. I mean, council tax, brutally for a London audience, is too low in London. And it needs to be higher.
You can tell it's not standing for relation here, can you?
I don't know whether Paul Johnson's here from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, but he worked out for me that he is great. If I've got this wrong, Paul, you must correct me. But I asked you what the yield would be from property taxation if the system in 1991 had still been in place and we revalued kind of residential property values in line kind of with the increase in property prices from then until now. I mean, it's astonishing that we're still basing council tax on revalue on 1991 values. It's one of the reasons why property prices, he said £20 billion. You can't get there in one jump, but this is the kind of way we've got to think. you know, it's going to take a decade, but we must do it because, you know, people, the Nat Cons talk about the decline in the birth rate. I mean, one of the reasons why people, you know, are having smaller families or deferring having families until they're well into their 30s, all the implications for kind of the birth rate, is because it's impossible to kind of live away, to kind of live with someone you love in your own place and bring up a family. I mean, it's impossible. We're killing our civilization with, and the social housing story is as disastrous. So, you know, I mean,
For me, I actually don't understand.
Sorry, I've got a long speech there.
No, but I think you make such an important point on social housing, because the only time this country has ever built enough houses is in the 30 years post-war, when we built significant numbers of houses with public investment as well as private investment. And for me, I just don't understand. I think it's a no-brainer for Labour, as well as their green investment plan. They should have a housing investment plan, and they should say, we're going to invest, we're going to borrow to invest, we're going to build affordable housing for rent for young people in city centres, and we're going to give them guaranteed, you know, tenancies for 3 to 5 years in their 20s so they can move somewhere where there are jobs. I mean, to me, that just seems like a good idea, no?
Yeah, it's a great
putting
idea.
It's a great idea.
And I think there's a chance that Labour will do that kind of thing.
Excellent.
I've just been a couple of weeks ago, I was in Australia. And something very interesting happened in Australia recently, which is that the Labour government got into power, defeated Scott Morrison, who was a kind of, you know, Johnson-type populist leader, pretty grim, pretty awful, dragged the mood down, like Keir was rightly saying the Tories have done here. And one of the promises they made, the Labour Party, mm-hmm. was that they would not interfere with Scott Morrison's three-stage tax plan. Okay, he had this quite complicated tax plan. They've had a budget, and what's the first thing they've done? They've gone back on it. And what's the response been? Unbelievably popular. Now, I'm not advocating breaking election promises, something that we never did. We had a pretty good record on that. But it's very, very interesting how that has happened, because what they've managed to do, and it may come back to bite them, but thus far, the Liberals, their Tory party, can't even bring themselves to attack this change because it's so popular. Because what they've done is they've basically changed the tax system to benefit the less well-off at the expense of the very well-off. Now, they've done it in power. They got into power in part by keeping quiet about it. Now, I think that what Keir is trying to do is, and I know that Will's here to sell his book, but I really recommend Tom Baldwin's book on Keir. It's a very interesting read, because, and I'm going to ask you this as a show of hands. Okay, you probably all agree with the tone of what we've been saying. We'd like more, we'd like faster, we'd like, you know, bolder and bigger and et cetera. But hands up if you kind of get what he's trying to do. You see?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
And so I think that's, we should go with that. And Will, when we were backstage, Will was saying to me, how do you get people who are disillusioned, who think that Labour's not perfect, how do you get them anyway to try and stick with it? And I know lots of people who are not happy with Labour over policy A, policy B, decision C, decision D. But in the end, we've just got to persuade each other, persuade ourselves and each other, that politics has never been a choice of two different forms of perfection. At the moment, it's a choice between, as I said earlier, this truly awful, wretched government and something that can be better. And so I think that I'm hoping... The reason why I'm recommending Tom's book is because at every stage of Keir's career and life, he's kind of been a bit underestimated all the time. And then he's set himself some pretty big ambitions, and he's always overreached. And so I'm hopeful that he's going to be more Attlee, maybe, than Blair. And yeah. I think that would be quite a good thing.
Yeah.
And you'll approve of that.
Oh, I once said to him, and I saw one of the quotes I came across was Kenneth Morgan is a biographer of Attlee, and he went to see Attlee, and kind of in the biography discusses kind of what Attlee's idea of socialism was. And Attlee replies, and it was like he uses it in a TV interview actually that he gave in the mid 50s. He says, "Well, I follow," he said, "the greatest citizen of this borough, William Morris, who said, socialism is fellowship, and fellowship is the life of the world, the hope of the world." And that's my definition of socialism. And I think that Keir, when he hears that, kind of immediately kind of thinks, that's me. Mm. I mean, he believes in fellowship. And I think he's also, he also believes in kind of pulling the shadow cabinet together as a team. And he does have some, he does have not Attlee type beasts, but he's got some quite good. He's got a potential kind of cabinet that could be as kind of game changing as the Attlee cabinets were. And there's people coming through who I think will get into the cabinet in a year one or year two of the Labour government. So I do agree with you. I think there's he's and the other thing that I think about Attlee and Keir is this. And I make this point in the book. I just talk about my book and not Tom's. what Attlee's always seen as the kind of socialist lion, really, the great socialist. But actually, as Attlee's wife said, Ken, talking to the biographer, Ken, you must understand, Clem was never a rabid, was never a socialist, or at least not a rabid socialist. And at that, Attlee, who'd been half asleep, sucking his pipe, jerked, and she qualified and lost the rabid. But he didn't really cavil in this notion when she went on to say that most of their friends were conservatives. And I think that people don't get the kind of Labour government of 45 to 51. I mean, yes, had brilliant people like Nye Bevan, who was an ethical socialist guy, but they were also kind of pursuing Keynesian policies, who was a progressive liberal. Beveridge was a progressive liberal, a new liberal. And he blended this new liberal tradition, progressive liberalism. And the Beveridge report is very interesting because, it's designed to provide social insurance for all, in a way we all know, but carefully designed not to take away individual responsibility or individual agency or responsibility for your own life. And actually, Attlee buys that. So, Attlee is kind of blending progressive liberalism, with its roots in 1906, 1914 kind of liberal government, with the socialism that people wanted after the war, and blended it to produce this great reforming administration, which then in the 50s, people like Macmillan and Churchill himself, who himself was a new liberal for a bit of his career, kind of were prepared to kind of run with. They built a consensus. And I see kind of some things he said tonight, kind of eyes pricked up. And I put the point to him about the Francis Bacon thing about kind of wealth is like Mark. He said he didn't resile from the notion in philosophic terms that Labour's about redistribution. Mm. And I thought, that's interesting. Mm. And he also wants to make an economy work for everybody, he said. He can't do that without getting a capitalism where the stock market rises so that companies like Shell aren't talking about relocating their quotation from the London market to New York. He kind of gets this. So we're bound to be disappointed, you and me, but I think there's really grounds. I'd much rather characterize where we are as the political glass being half full and potentially fillable, if that's the right way. I'm not sure that's right, actually. Fillable? Anyway.
Fillable.
Yeah, I think fillable, yeah. I need a good sword editor. Rather than half empty and emptying. So, it was great you give him the applause that you gave him, because I think I've kind of lifted his spirits, I don't think he doesn't get enough kind of quasi-neutral audiences, we'll lean into this.
Oh, yeah, really neutral. Absolutely. I can feel the neutrality of the room.
It's not the Labour Party conference, is it?
It's not far off. Hands up anybody who's going to vote Tory.
I've got one in the
one,
back.
One brave man. Good, well done, sir.
No, but it's not... I mean, it isn't a Liberty conference where they kind of, you know, no, you've got a staff of 3 minutes every kind of, you know...
No, but I'll tell you, I a lot of this depends on kind of what mood we're in. So I could... I mean, Keir and I have had many arguments about Brexit. I want Labour to be far more upfront about the damage that Brexit is doing and the absolute necessity to meet growth mission number one.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right, yeah. And I also, I'm absolutely obsessed with this belief that, and I felt it last week when the Mail and the Tories were going mad about Angela Rayner yet again, I want Labour to stand up and absolutely say that the restoration of standards in politics and public life is going to be fundamental, and I want them to do it and mean it. And likewise, there is stuff in, he mentioned schools and the curriculum, there's stuff in the curriculum that I think you can really, really make some big changes. Now, is that the stuff that they're talking about? No. Does that frustrate me? Yes. But I'm, you know, been around long enough to know that provided you've got a sense, and I think the more, I think the country's getting to know Keir in a way that it hasn't, and it won't, unless and until he gets into power. But I think there's something in there that is kind of fundamentally decent, mm-hmm. and does have values and is tough. And Will makes the point. I mean, Will writes in the book about, you know, probably most of you will know that I don't have a lot of time for much of our media, present company excluded.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah. But you know, it is a factor. It is a factor. We danced with the devil, and Keir's doing a bit of dancing with the devil. And I would like him to commit to doing Leveson Part 2, the whole press corruption stuff. He's decided not to. I understand why. I'd rather that he did. But all the time, I think it's important that we're all kind of just a bit grown up about this and understand, as he said, if you don't get into power, you can't do anything. You spend your whole, you know, life, as many of us have done for decades, kind of in frustration, in anger, just sort of, you know, wanting the country to change but not being able to will it. So I think it's more that even if the glass is only half full, it's better than the alternative, and it's the alternative we've got to help him get rid of.
Thank you.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
Questions in the audience very shortly, so do have a think about what you'd like to ask Will and Alistair. There's one more question I just wanted to put to you both first, and Will, you mentioned beverage, which of course brings us onto poverty and child poverty.
Yep.
We've got rising levels of child poverty. Almost a third of British children now live in relative poverty, which I think is a stain on a country as rich as ours.
Yep.
We've got a widening attainment gap at school, partly buoyed by pandemic learning loss. And last week we had new research from the Institute for Fiscal Studies showing that in its early incarnation, Sure Start was actually fantastically effective at closing the attainment gap. What is Labour going to do about child poverty and the fact that for children, you know, growing up in poorer households, that will affect them, we know, for the rest of their lives in terms of their education, employment and health outcomes? What do you think Labour is saying enough on that?
No. I mean, I'm going to end up repeating your question, Sonia. We have the shortest five-year-olds in Europe. And there's attempts in kind of right-wing webinars to suggest that's because we've been deluged by kind of immigrants who are small, and they have. But we all know the reason. The reason is that the large parts of our cities, I mean, the levels of nutrition are kind of disastrously poor, and people's teeth are phenomenally, you know, kind of just decaying. And the amount of dental pain people are going through is extraordinarily, and kids, you know. And I thought this Breakfast Club commitment by kind of Keir and team was a good one. But I think it, of course, it got kind of criticized for being the nanny state. One of the things I do in the book is I talk a bit about Harold Macmillan and his book, The Middle Way, written in 1938, a Tory, who writes a book as, in some respects, as kind of aggressively radical as the state we're in, or This Time No Mistakes. I was really taken aback. Keynesian wants to really reshape the British financial system and all the things I've talked about how to get growth in 1938. But his big thing is the impact of poverty on kind of life expectancy, lived experience, and just hunger, and the impact on people's lives, and the illness and kind of and deprivation that follows from it. And so he wanted to establish a national nutrition board that would instruct every local government in the country to make certain every single family had minimal nutritional levels every day. And he set out kind of what it would cost and what that would be. And I was just thinking of kind of what a conservative put that on the table in 1938, and saying that it was imperative to kind of keep democracy on the on the road, and to kind of avoid the temptations of going communist and all the rest of it, and it was necessary to fight fascism and all those things that you would think in 1938. But the reaction to it was kind of, well, that's not a bad idea. You know, spool forward to 2024, and the reaction to the Breakfast Club is kind of, oh, you know, how dare the state intrude into family choices. You know, kids can arrive at school kind of at 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, you know, hungry, and that's fine. There needs to be that kind of Macmillan-esque thinking about, you know, our kids. As I said earlier, the life chances of, you know, it shouldn't be true that actually that your life chances depend so completely, as they do in the UK, about the from whose womb you sprung, the circumstances of the family into which you are born. I mean, I quote the great kind of American philosopher John Rawls. You know, if you didn't know who you were going to be born to, the good society is one in which it shouldn't matter behind a veil of ignorance into which society you were born into. We are so miles away from that in 2024, and I just see the kids playing in the playground of a primary school, and you can, and you think, what's going to their life going to be like over the next 10, 15, 20 years? What's my generation done to kind of give them kind of the possibilities that I had growing up in the 50s and 60s? You know, so your point is well made, and it would be great to see kind of the Labour Party picking up Alistair's point, kind of being brave about our children in the way that you've described.
Alistair, one of the things that New Labour really did was tackle child poverty through tax credits and redistribution. And if you look at the figures, the average family in the poorest decile, so the poorest tenth of families with children, has lost £4,000 a year on average as a result of conservative changes to the tax benefit system. How on earth can Labour fix this without directing more cash at poor families? A lot of that is in work poverty, by the way, of course, as you well know.
Yeah, they can't. They can't. And I think they know that. And this thing, I think it's right that our poorest children are now poorer than children in some of the poorest, traditionally poorest countries in Europe. I'll tell you, one of the things that's happened is that poverty, and to be fair, Gordon Brown's still banging on about this relentlessly, and he's right to do so. Poverty has just kind of fallen off the media and political agenda.
I agree.
And that is really, really dangerous because, one, it's terrible for those people that they feel that they're voiceless, that they're not part of the mainstream debate. And secondly, I think that is further opening the door to the populace who will come along and say, you've been let down by the mainstream, you've been let down by the main parties, etc. So Labour has got to put poverty right at the heart of its agenda. Again, I'm hopeful that they will. Mm-hmm. And the point is, you know, it's interesting, Will mentioned the thing about, you know, diet and so forth. And then we had exactly the same reaction. You mentioned teeth. Where Streeting came along and said they were going to be, you know, teaching children how to brush their teeth. Now, on one level, it is absurd and obscene that we're even having to have that conversation. But the truth is that we are having to have that conversation. And that teaching kids the value of dental hygiene is a fit and proper thing to do in schools. And yet, when that happened, you had the usual suspects screaming about the nanny state. The truth is, we're going to have a bit more of the nanny state. Sure Start was nanny state in the eyes of those who criticised it. And I've got to say, I welcomed Paul's report last week. I thought it was a really impressive piece of work. But the fact is, getting rid of Sure Start is one of the worst acts of vandalism that this lot have done. And it's because they didn't invent it. But it's also because deep down, I'm sorry to say this, and I hope, oh, is he gone? No, he's still there. I'm sorry to say this to the guy who's still going to vote for them. I actually am afraid, have reached the conclusion, they genuinely don't care about that stuff. Their whole messaging is focused very, very narrowly on a section of the electorate that they think put them in power, that they think gave them Brexit and all the stuff that's followed since then. And I think it's utterly obscene that we now have, we used to call it the underclass. We now have a very sizable section of our fellow citizens who are just, they've just vanished from the political debate. And the Labour Party's got to get them back into the centre of the political debate because, again, their growth mission won't happen without them.
Very good point. I would now like to open it up to questions from the floor. I'm going to take them in threes. I'm going to go to the lady over there, first of all. Thank you. There's a roving mic that's going to come round.
She's the one with my book.
Oh, excellent. That's not why I picked her.
Good taste.
My name's Colette Hazeldine. I'm about to launch a business called greenstableuk.org, which will give 68% of gross profits to animal, environmental and energy vulnerable people causes. And in preparing my business for launch, I've looked at the 7 Nolan principles of ethical standards in public life, how to apply it to a private enterprise. Mm-hmm. And it's because I'm new to all of this, I'm shocked at how little that is actually being adhered to in public office. Mm. Now, I can't wait for the general election, but why is it we can't do something now to force our elected officials to stick to those standards?
Great. Thank you very much. And then if you don't mind just passing the mic one forward, the gentleman just in front of you had a question. I'm looking for one more question as well. All right, great, excellent. I'll go to the lady right at the back there in the white afterwards. So, yeah.
Hi, my name's Noah Hughes. I've recently founded a think tank called the Centre for Systemic Economic Thinking. This question isn't directly related to our research, but hints towards where we're going. So tonight there's been a lot of talk about growth and growing the economy, but Keir also observed that growth isn't felt by all. Does this mean we are looking at the wrong metrics and therefore policy is being guided by wrong economic theory?
Thank you. And then lady in the white over there, have you got a mic?
What are you launching?
Oh, she hasn't got a mic. Yeah.
So hopefully a Labour government, because I am standing in the next general election in South Derbyshire.
Yeah.
Thank you. So to your point, both of you, I'm out talking to people every day, every week on their doorstep, every day if I could, quite frankly. And I see the change in their faces from absolute despair to hope. I see that move across their face as they talk to me. My question is, I have a plan for South Derbyshire myself. I know that the Labour Party has a plan nationally. But if we get into power, God willing, if we get into power, how long do you think it's going to take for people to start to feel the benefit of it? Because there'll be this hope getting up to a general election, and then there'll be joy that we've won the general election, God willing, touching wood. But how long before people go from going, oh, you're all the same, to, oh, my goodness, I'm feeling this?
Thank you very much. Will, I'm going to come to you first, if that's all right, on the question about whether we've got the right indicators of growth.
Well, the strategy, isn't it?
Economic theory,
yeah.
Yeah, but I thought you asked about whether we're measuring the right thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a whole, I do discuss this a bit, actually. I've talked about this public investment, but it's going to have a huge it's going to have a huge environment bias. We have to take not just the target for net zero, but the wider issues of sustainability and biodiversity and all of that, fundamentally seriously. But you can't get anywhere, whether it be the kind of water companies or the kind of grid, unless you have the kind of resources going into kind of investment. So, what's happened in economic theory in the last kind of 25 years is that, in the 80s and 90s, the idea was that public borrowing crowded out private borrowing because private business would do the investment, and they'd be deterred by higher interest rates if public borrowing crowded their efforts out. That now been turned on its head. We're now talking about the old Keynesian proposition that actually public investment crowds in business investment. And the character of public investment, if it's focused on levelling up, if it's focused on particular kinds of R&D, kind of biotech and medtech, if it's focused on kind of environment, a drive to net zero, will crowd in the kinds of companies that are doing that kind of thing. And you will start to change the kind of balance of your economic structure. So that's how that's my answer to your question, I guess. I'm just repeating myself, but where I understand economic theory has got to. It's a kind of contemporary Keynesianism. Of course, there are constraints to public investment. Of course, you have to get returns from it. Of course, it has to be part of these five missions that Keir set out. But I am really hopeful that will happen and happen at scale. And to pick up the point from Derbyshire, South Derbyshire, how long will it take to come through? Look, it needs to come through within 2 or 3 years. I mean the politics of the UK at the minute with reform, where the Tory party have got to, a kind of our politics of hatred, really, kind of emerging, and Europhobia. It's very dark, and keeping that at bay requires that this kind of policy framework that we're talking about kind of works and actually starts to manifest itself within 2 or 3 years. I mean, the build-up will take longer. It will take 6, 7, 8 years. But I think that signs of improvement should be visible within 30 months is my answer to your question.
Thanks, Will. I'm going to bring you in, Alistair, in just a second. I just need to say, sorry to jump in, that there are two mics on the balcony. And if you want to ask a question, you need to queue on either side. And I will come to the balcony after. So, Alistair, what's
the
two?
I'm going to link the other two questions. I think the answer about why I'm one of those sad people who can quote the Nolan principles without looking them up: honesty, openness, objectivity, selflessness, integrity, accountability, and leadership.
Well done.
Why? Thank you. Why did I memorise those? Because I was convinced the minute that Boris Johnson ridiculously became Prime Minister, I was convinced that ultimately they were going to be his downfall. And I'm glad to say I think I was proved right in that. Johnson did not go because of the Brexit. He didn't even go because of Partygate. He went ultimately because even his own ridiculous party realised he smashed every single one of those principles. Why are they not more central in the debate? Partly, I think, because Labour don't make them more central. I think they should, and I hope that they will during the campaign. I think they will. But also because we do have the media that we've got. Just look at what's happened recently with Angela Rayner. An utter non-story, so far as I can work out. And yet newspapers which are ignoring sort of willy-waving, honey-trapping MPs, ignoring, COVID multi-million pound contracts to their mates, ignoring £50 million donations that get you a peerage or a knighthood, I forget which it was, and yet we'll go for that. So it's partly the media and it's partly the Tories. But I think ultimately it's about Labour saying we're going to put this at the heart of our debate. The thing about I think two to three years is a problem. That's why, you see, I think this stuff, public standards, changes that you can make to the curriculum, the stuff that you can do early on that signals change. And that's what I said earlier about the joy that many, many people are going to feel. You've got to tap into that straight away by making change. And a lot of it doesn't have to cost money. If I think about some of the big changes that we made early on, Bank of England was obviously a massive change. Bank of England independence. Now, that was, I would hope most people would agree, kind of net positive to the economy, net positive certainly to our political fortunes. And then when you talk then about the getting the economy growing, once that happens, you've got to show that you are genuinely doing the things that you said you were doing, putting flesh on the words. So when Keir says an economy that works for all, not just certain parts of the country, that's going to mean something. So what are we going to do about devolution to the regions? What are we going to do about more elected mayors and all that sort of stuff, which I hope will happen. So I think that it's not going to be, Will's right, that the populist stuff's going to be very, very difficult. You look at the European elections going on at the moment. I don't think the far right are going to do as well as people say, but they're going to do far better than they should. Okay. Now we, in a way, because we've got a pretty right-wing conservative government, and you've got Farage and Reform hanging around as well, we don't. That is our version of that problem. But that problem with a Labour government, with a media that is going to be pretty vile about a Labour government, that is going to become difficult quite quickly. So we have to be showing people all the time we are making change that is a benefit to their lives. And you know, it's not going to be easy, but I hope you win.
Have we got some mics on the balcony now? Is that excellent? So let's, oh, wonderful. We can have our first question from the balcony.
Hi, my name is Susuma. I'm a Year 12 student at Mulberry School for Girls. I'm 17 years old, and I'm also the young mayor for Tower Hamlet. And I just wanted to quickly ask, you said earlier that there has been a high interest in politics recently. As a young person, I severely disagree. I think apathy persists in politics. Young people are overlooked and ignored by policymakers. Politicians ignore the electorate, and we have seen this recently with the public outburst with the events in Gaza. Those in safe seats have no voice. Is it time for a change to a system of proportional representation? Thank you.
Well, I think that cheer was actually bigger than the cheer you all gave here, so that's pretty impressive, really. I'm going to take a couple more questions. Can I see some hands? Great, we'll go to the gentleman there with the sunglasses on his head. Sorry, that's just the easiest way of identifying you.
Hi, my name's Sam. I'm 22. Actually, former student of yours, Will, from back in the day.
All right. Welcome. Good to see you.
Yeah, I know that Keir is looking at what Joe Biden's doing in the United States and specifically at what they're doing on the economy. But one of the things that is increasingly being pointed out that Biden might have missed out on is the democratic renewal aspect of the reason why Trump was elected. And I worry that debates around, say, reform of the House of Lords, stuff like that, have been swept under the rug by the cost of living crisis. And do we need to focus on democratic renewal as much as economic renewal?
Great.
Absolutely is the answer.
And one more question. Oh, lady at the front here.
Hi, my name's Gabrielle. I'm old. I'm just concerned.
I think the term is middle age these days.
I've got my senior role card. Anyway,
I think I understand where Keir's coming from in one point, and something that Alistair said, which is, having been around the Obama campaign, there was this huge expectation set about we're going to win, we're going to do this, and we're going to change things. Maybe we should set our sights a little lower and exceed them. So from that point of view, do you agree with that or not? Rather than going, rah, rah, we're going to do this, I'm going to do that, you know, 5-year, 10-year plan.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. So, Will, I can tell you're salivating at the prospect of answering questions on House of Lords reform and proportional representation.
It's a big theme in the book. I mean,
I know it is.
You're going to love the book if you. I mean, look.
Yeah, my book's written for young people.
Proportional representation. 1908 was there was an inquiry on it. It recommended in 1910 we should have proportional representation. In 1918, when the Parliament Act came through at the last years of the First World War, there was another debate in the House of Commons, and there could have been a majority for proportional representation if Ramsay MacDonald hadn't plumped for first past the post. And it's so it goes on. And if you look at the course of the last 125 years, consistently, proportional representation has thrown up a House of Commons who does not reflect the body of opinion in the country. It could be in 1951, when actually Labour had won the popular vote by kind of some margin, but didn't have enough, didn't win, as you know, the seats in the House of Commons. It could have been in 1929, when actually the Liberals and the Labour Party together kind of trumped the Tory vote, and there could have been a majority for a much more sure-footed reaction to slump. Didn't happen. I mean, the opposite, the PR conferred in 1983 of a second term Tory government, when actually the then SDP and the Labour Party kind of outpolled the Tories, and so it goes on. The time has come, I think, for us to kind of take the way we vote, much more seriously. We can't go on with the most primitive voting system you can conceive of, which is first past the post. And it segues into the whole point about democratic renewal that was made. I mean, if in 2050 we are still with an unreformed House of Lords, with nearly by then 1,000 peers who will have been appointed, and even if hereditaries get abolished, I think they will probably be in the first year of a Labour government, but not much more. There's no commitment to have an elected kind of the elected Senate that Gordon Brown called for. You know, we will live in a failed state. You know, this question of proportional representation and having a democracy that actually reflects our opinion, that actually there's a public square where ideas like this can be exchanged and acted on, is fundamental to the vitality of a civilization. So these are really, really important questions, and you know, I try to drive it home in the book. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Connor Boyle and edited by Tom Hall. If you'd like even more of that conversation, you can listen to our Members Only Part 3, featuring an extended audience Q&A right now by heading over to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. I've been Connor Boyle. Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared.